Hello and welcome. I'm your co-host, Siobhan Sarna, founder of SIBO SOS, and I'm here with my fellow co-host, Dr. Allison Seebecker. Hi, Allison.
Hello.
Hello, my friend, who is the founder of SIBO Info and a lifelong student and fortunately an advocate for all of us, just like I am, about SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. And she is a SIBO patient herself, as am I. And Dr. Seebecker and I started collaborating, I don't know how many years ago now, Allison, like 2016. And yeah. As a result, we have been working to educate the world about these conditions, SIBO, EMO, IBS, and what to do about it. Now, we have a very special guest. His name is Dr. Ali Rezai. And we use the excuse that DDW, Digestive Disease Week 2023, has completed, and we use that as a prompt and a lever to get him to come on and talk to us. So we would love to talk to him every day, but we make it this annual tradition. And if you haven't heard of Dr. Ali Rezai, you will hear more about him. In the world of gastroenterology, he certainly is well known. He is a specialist and irritable bowel syndrome, gut microbiome, internal UV therapy. Fascinating. He's published well over 100 research articles in peer-reviewed journals, including Gastroenterology, American Journal of Gastroenterology, Digestive Diseases and Science and Canadian and Sciences and Canadian Journal of Gastroenterology. Now, his work has been cited more than, count it, 8,000 times by other scientific journals. He serves as the associate editor of the Journal of Digestive Disease and Sciences. He is out of Cedars-Sinai and medical director of the Gastroenterology Motility Cedars-Sinai Medicine. He is director of Bioinformatics and Biotechnology Medically Assisted Associated, Science and Technology Program, also known as MAST Program at Cedars-Sinai. He and his colleague, Dr. Mark Pimentel, are changing the world in terms of the microbiome, mapping the small intestine microbiome, and helping us all come up with ways to live with SIBO and EMO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and intestinal methanogen overgrowth. Until they come up with a cure, no pressure. Hi, Dr. Rezai.
Hello, and thank you so much for that kind introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here. Again.
Yeah, we love having you. We love having you back. Yay! Yeah. So Digestive Disease Week, the largest gastroenterology conference, just sort of wrapped. And I know you all were presenting some phenomenal information. Tell us what your highlights were. What are you excited about? What do you want the world to know about?
Yeah, so I'm very optimistic. The world is moving very fast, especially in the field of microbiome. And we have been playing around with microbiome and trying to modify it. And now we're seeing that the treatments and the diagnostic tests are getting to a point that patients can be helped. And that's the eventual goal. And that is very exciting to see. And every time that we see new technologies, new developments, and all of those will help delineate exactly what we need to do and what bacteria need to be targeted, what fungi need to be targeted, what viruses need to be targeted, and what is the interaction between these three, right? So, and also the archaea. So it's exciting times, and happy to share some of those data and talk about them, whichever route you want to take it.
Yeah. Well, if it's okay with you, can we talk about IMO, methanogen overgrowth? Because a lot of times I get feedback on our YouTube channel and in the Facebook group, now closing in on about 30,000 people. They're like, okay, I don't hear enough about IMO. I hear a lot about SIBO, which if you could explain the nuance between those two conditions, so there's no confusion that they're totally different, because happened for a little bit. Yeah. And then let's start there and we'll move along the.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we step back. So all of these fall under microbial overgrowth syndromes, right? So these are diseases that certain group of microbes overgrow. And obviously when that balance goes away, they cause trouble. So the most known condition under that category is obviously SIBO. But then we have small intestinal fungal overgrowth, when the fungi is overgrowing, and that becomes a problem. And we can talk about that as well, because there was a lot of data about that at DDW as well. And then when the methanogens increase. So, and remember, eventually we will figure out what happens when the viral component of microbiome will be in balance. So that will come, but obviously the research in that field is much tougher and harder, considering the bacteriophages and also viruses. But what are the archaea? Archaea, if you think about domains of life, so we have life, and then it breaks down into three categories. It breaks into archaea, it breaks down into bacteria, and then breaks down into eukarya. So who are the eukarya? It's essentially all the fungi, all us, everything with like big cells. But then on the other side are the archaea and bacteria, and they're completely different. They're different domains of life. They're as different as they are to bacteria as we are to bacteria. They're that different. They're completely do different things. And they were the original microorganisms that showed up. And that's why they can produce different weird gases such as methane that we're now understanding what's the role of these gases as well. So traditionally, we considered archaea, which produce methane, to be harmless guys. They're just hanging out and they don't have much of a role. They're just there. But obviously, that's not true. Whenever you ignore part of nature, you just get burned at the end. And now we're understanding that most of the times, actually, they are there to help us. But sometimes they can just behave abnormally and they can cause a problem. So one of the gases that they produce is methane. They do produce other gases as well. And what's interesting is that by itself, methane is active in our body. So there's some gases in our body that they don't have much of a physiologic effects. For example, hydrogen. Hydrogen is just a gas, goes around, doesn't attach to any receptor. It just causes a little bit of a trouble and distension. And then eventually we breathe it out. The CH4 or methane is different because it does have physiologic effects. And if the best example of gases having physiologic effects, what we call actually gasotransmitters, are the ether, right? And all the gases that we use in anesthesia. So those are just gases. If you think about it, they just go in, halothane goes in, and then 20 seconds later, you're unconscious, right? So these are gases that can have physiological effects. And methane is one of them. And what we have shown is that they can affect the function of smooth muscles. Smooth muscles are the muscles that we don't have control over. We have two types of muscles, right? So we have skeletal muscles in our body that we have control over, the way that I'm moving my hands. But we have smooth muscles that are in our heart, that are in our gut, bladder, uterus. And these we do not have control over, and our body controls them. Methane can affect the function of these smooth muscles. And the primary site that it affects is gut. So it leads to spastic contractions of the smooth muscles. So the movement of the gut is not as good. And that leads obviously to abdominal cramps. And when the bowel is not moving, with it comes dysbiosis. So obviously the balance of bacteria and also fungi and also methanogens go away, and that becomes a problem. And because the bowels are spastic, these spasms are not propagating. They don't let the gut move forward. They are essentially useless contractions as opposed to be coordinating. So this leads to slowing of the bowel transit that leads to constipation very commonly in these patients, or the IBS mix, meaning that some days they're constipated, some days they're on the looser side. They alternate depending on how much gas is in there. So very commonly they have IBS mix type or IBS constipation type. And it's interesting because there's one study actually done by Magnus Simbrin in Sweden that was presented at DDW, that they did very interesting study because previously Mark Pimentel did show that if you infuse methane gas into a small intestinal lumen of dogs, it slows down. What they showed is that in over 150 patients and also over 30 healthy controls, those who have elevated methane, they give them a smart pill, which goes in and measures the transit of the gut. And what they showed is that doesn't matter if you are a healthy control or even even our IBS patients, if you have excessive amount of methane, your colonic transit is double the time of somebody who doesn't have methane, which is actually very fascinating, the data that they're showing, and hopefully they will publish this very soon. But that was one of the fascinating studies that I saw. So hope that kind of at least differentiated what is intestinal methanogen overgrowth versus small intestinal bacteria overgrowth. Another point that I want to make is that this overgrowth can happen in small bowel, can happen in the colon, can happen in both. So it's not necessarily just in the small bowel, and that's a very important point to notice. Sorry, I talked a little bit too long on that one, but there was good data that I can go over as well regarding EMO, but I stopped there and see what you guys think.
Well, I think that's a perfect I want to know more, but I also want to ask you about what we were talking before we hit the record button, which is if it's in the small intestine and it's overgrown also in the large intestine, you know, when we think about people testing the microbiome prior to your work with MAST, there was just stool tests. Mm-hmm. So what can we look forward to in the future? And what are you all doing now about mapping the different microbiomes of the intestines?
Right. Because remember, all the tests that we used to do and more than 90% of the microbiome tests that are being done still focuses on bacteria, right? Mm-hmm. And just focusing on bacteria, you're not going to pick up the archaea. So you need different technique of deep sequencing on catching them. Now, obviously, shotgun sequencing is now becoming more prevalent and a little bit cheaper, but it's still extremely expensive. That's why a lot of research and teams, including us, struggle to find funding to do shotgun sequencing because it's very expensive, does pick up archaea as well. Maybe I just open up that one because it's kind of interesting. So 16S sequencing, when we say 16S, that's just a segment of the gene of the bacteria that is very stable throughout the evolution. So no matter what bacteria are out there, they have that segment and it looks like a barcode. And we can look at it and say that, hey, this is in the Klebsiella family. This one is in the E. coli family. So because you're just looking at a small segment of these bacteria, then it's much cheaper to look at and you can quickly do it. But the problem is that it's similar to looking at the last names with ignoring the first names, right? So you're looking at all the Smiths out there. So it was like, okay, this person is Smith, but you can't go deep enough because outside of that 16S, you have to look to say that, oh, is this John Smith or like Kevin Smith or Martha, right? So you can't go that deep when you have this 16S. Shotgun is different. Shotgun looks at the whole genome, looks at it, was like, okay, whatever I get, I look at it. That's why it's much more expensive and much more time consuming in terms of gathering the data and also analyzing the data. So the supercomputers that we use to break these, analyze these data is just, we just got them essentially in the last few years that is now commercially viable. So that's the advantage. But when you have the shotgun, you can go all the way, not to the genus, but even to the strain of the bacteria, what exactly that is. And that's the difference. But it comes with one issue, though. It picks up the genome of everything, including food that you eat, including yourself, so there is a lot of noise. So it has introduced a new bioinformatic challenge that you have to denoise the data and take that out. But I mean, that's just the evolution of medicine that we have to go through. But that's why we are trying to move from 16S to shotgun. But obviously that's expensive, but that's a transition that is occurring. That's that point that I wanted to make about 16S and deep sequencing. So what's the good news here? The good news is that when you do 16S, you mostly pick up the bacteria. You can pick up the fungi. You can pick up viruses. You can pick up some of the archaea, but not all of them. But now that you're doing shotgun, now there's going to be a host of new data that are focusing on not just bacteria, but also on different parts like fungi and archaea. And more importantly, interaction of these three, right? Along with the viruses. And that will become more complex, but definitely that's a bigger picture to look at. And that's pretty much the future.
Well, that's exciting. Let's talk about fungus because you brought it up a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people in our communities, you know, toy with the idea, maybe they have a candida overgrowth. I've tried all the usual treatments for SIBO and EMO, and I even have a negative SIBO breath test or not, and mm-hmm. I'm just not getting better. How yeah. often do you feel like a fungus plays a role in that? And if someone's like, fungus among us, I've never even thought about that, you guys. Like, what is it?
Right. So the concept of fungi growing in a small bowel, it's not a new one. It goes back more than half a century. That's interesting enough. In the New England Journal of Medicine, they quantified how much fungi exists in the small bowel and the large bowel. And that's amazingly, that cutoff still holds. What we showed actually on this DDW is that we went to the small bowel. Now we can pick up the fungi now with the new technology. And we did a deep sequencing on them. And long and behold, patients who have more than 10^3 fungal elements in the small bowel do have more abdominal pain. And interesting enough, the more you fungi that you have, the more actually a SIBO you have. It was interesting to see that they do actually interact with each other. Not all SIBO patients had excessive amount of fungi, but almost all patients with excessive amount of fungi did have SIBO on top as well, which is fascinating, which shows what we call microbiome bacterial interactome, which is essentially the interaction of these two, which is definitely interesting. Now, in concordance with the previous data, the dominant fungi in the gut belongs to Candida family. And I'm talking about plus 90%. Now, Candida albicans, Candida glabrata, those are the two common ones that are in there. So there's definitely a concept of small intestinal fungal overgrowth exists. There appears not to be much of a correlation with small intestinal fungal overgrowth and amount of candida in the stool, which is not surprising considering how much bacteria is in there and how much interactions in there. They suppress the fungal growth in there. So that's the newest sort of approach that is definitely puts CFO on the map for future research and target for treatment for sure.
Speaking of target for treatment, do you ever see patients where you're like, I think, you know, even if you didn't scope them, I think you probably have a fungal overgrowth. And then mm-hmm. do you change the treatment at all? And what would be that indicator to you, that clue that they may have a fungal overgrowth?
Yeah, I mean, one of the situation is that, well, breath test is negative. Remember, fungi don't produce hydrogen or methane or even hydrogen sulfide. So I can't pick them up on a breath test, right? They produce carbon dioxide, but I mean, how am I supposed to pick carbon dioxide because I'm producing it myself? So it's hard to differentiate a microbial CO2 from a human CO2. It's essentially impossible. So I generally prefer to do endoscopy and do a small bowel aspirate and do fungal culture and see if the patient has small intestinal fungal overgrowth. Because even though it's there, it's definitely less common than SIBO. The advantage of aspirate is that it tells me what type of fungi it is, right? So because the treatment and the dose of treatment may be different, for example, between Candida albicans and Candida glabrata. Candida glabrata is more resistant. So definitely that's my preferred route. But, you know, you have to be practical sometimes. You have a patient that is not responding to a usual SIBO treatment and other promotility treatment and whatever treatment that you have done regarding abdominal pain and abdominal bloating and distension. And that's the time that we may consider empiric therapy, although obviously that's an off-label therapy, but after reading out the risks and benefits of the treatments that we use.
Are you thinking like nystatin? Like what are some of those therapies?
That's what I was going to ask. And specifically, what if you get Candida glabrata, which is more resistant? What do you find works for that?
Yeah, well, so that's another interesting that you said, because when you have you do grow Candida glabrata, then you ask the microbiology lab, I was like, okay, can you tell me what this is sensitive to? And even when they say that, okay, for example, it's sensitive to fluconazole, but then they tell you at what MIC, they tell you at what dose, right? So for example, if they say that, hey, the usual dose may not work, you need to double or even triple the dose in Candida glabrata. And so microbiology lab is able to tell you. It's usually fluconazole sensitive, but it needs a higher dose than Candida albicans. And that's not something unknown. We do know that based on the cases of when patients have Candida fungemia, when the Candida is in the blood, for example, in the setting of endocarditis, that's a well-known fact that if it's glabrata, you need a higher dose of antifungals to treat that.
Wow. You know, some people may not realize the scope conversation that we need to reveal here about how you developed that special scope that doesn't get contaminated and all of that. If you could clarify that for everyone, because it's breaking news, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because one thing that let's talk about how we do aspirate from the small bowel, right? So you go for endoscopy, you're under anesthesia. So we go with a scope through the mouth. At back of the throat, usually there is much of the saliva is sitting there, right? So we actually aspirate that amount of saliva sitting there if it's too much and suction it because, well, it can go to your lungs. So we don't want a patient to aspirate at that time. Then we go into the esophagus. If there is like a little bit of a gunk and a little bit of saliva that is in there, so we suction it, right? And then we go to the stomach. If there's excessive amount of fluid, again, we suction it so that as those stuff doesn't come back to your esophagus, go to your lung and you aspirate, right? So that's a complication that can happen with endoscopy. So we counteract that by suctioning whatever we see, right? So this leads to that suction channel of endoscope to be totally contaminated by the time that you get into the small bowel. It's just all gunk from the throat all the way to the stomach that is just sitting there, right? So that suction channel is already contaminated. So if I go into the small bowel and suction just with that suction channel, obviously all that stuff is going to come to that sort of a collection tube that I have. And obviously, when I send it to a microbiology lab, it's going to grow all sorts of things, including respiratory tract bacteria, which the same as gut microbiome, we do have respiratory microbiome, and that's not abnormal if I pick up some of those, for example, some Haemophilus if I pick up. And also, you know, saliva is also has a lot of bacteria, Streptomyces and all that. That's the native bacteria in the gut. So the next round of improvement was that, okay, let's send a catheter, a sterile catheter through the channel that has an open tip, and it goes to the small bowel and let's suction with that. But the problem is that while you're pushing that catheter in and the tip is open, obviously some of this stuff will go in. So it decreases the amount of contamination, but definitely doesn't eliminate it. Now, the second sort of iteration and the most revolutionary part is that now we have two catheters inside of each other, and there is a membrane at the tip. So when we go through, first we go through the small bowel, and then when we're in the small bowel, finally the inner tube comes out and advances into the small bowel and starts suctioning, and that kind of eliminates the contamination risk. So this was a lot of work. The problem is that when you put two plastic tubes, which catheters are made out of, on top of each other, they don't move well, right? Now you're inside the scope, you have a bent scope, it just doesn't move, right? So the friction of two plastic on top of each other is just doesn't move well. And it was a lot of engineering that went through that to make that happen with different types of material going in each catheter, the inner and outer sheet, to make it able for that catheter to slide through that. So that's how we do the aspiration now to decrease the chance of contamination. And that's why some of the aspiration studies in the past, when you look at it, don't correlate with breath testing. Well, because they're contaminated, right? So Mayo Clinic, for example, just published, Brian Lacey published a paper 2 years ago that showed that that single lumen technique has 19.6%, 20% false positivity rate. So 1/5 of your samples are like, well, it's saliva. And so it's not accurate. And 20% in the world of microbiome, that's a lot, because that will skew your results significantly. So and this double catheter eliminates that issue.
What are the chances of the double catheter going, you know, global? I was talking to a local gastroenterologist here, and I was talking about that. He goes, oh, it'd be so great if I had one of those. You know, it's not mainstream yet.
Yeah. So again, the main issue is actually making this sort of very delicate catheter, like mass producing it. But hey, I'm not going to promise, but we will have it unless something goes unusually wrong, commercially available probably in winter 2024.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah. May I have the name of it, the catheter?
The catheter, we called it EndoLotus. Because, we call it Lotus catheter because the way I designed it, at the tip, it has capillary. So the inner catheter has multiple capillary tubes. So I was inspired by how, because if you think about it, how does a sequoia sucks water from the ground all the way to like whatever it is, 60 yeah. meters high up. It's through capillaries, right? So they suction and things come up. And small bowel is a very dry sort of organ, interesting enough, especially after fasting, that you need to do for endoscopy. So this inner catheter has multiple capillaries, just like the roots of trees, and it goes through and it kind of like sucks and wicks that fluid out into the catheter. So that also helps us. Because sometimes we go in there and it's bone dry, but we can always wick out of it, which this catheter will be do. So I called it EndoLotus because have you cut the roots of lotus? It's like those like they're not the capillary, but there is like the air pockets, but it is actually, that's how it looks like at the tip. It looks like a horizontally cut root of a lotus.
Well, that's beautiful, almost like a honeycomb. That's so cool.
Exactly. Yes.
That's so
cool. You know, and Ali, while you're talking about that and about the lineup, the disconnect that had existed between culture testing, you know, the gold standard, which now you've significantly improved with this technique, and various forms of breath testing, can you just comment out about glucose breath testing versus lactulose? And you know, we see often in the studies that glucose can look better in studies, but in practice, we find lactulose works better. Many of us do. Can you just discuss all this and then the culture lineup? And
I can't agree with you more. I think obviously people like glucose because the idea is that it does not reach the colon. On the other hand, lactulose has a chance of reaching the colon eventually because it doesn't get absorbed. So you may pick up the colonic fermentation if you continue the test for a long time. So it was just a battle of specificity and sensitivity of these two. So one main issue was that a breath testing kept being compared to aspiration, and aspiration has two issues, right? So number one, contamination. So 20% of the times your gold standard has false positive. So, I mean, that's essentially a tin standard. The second issue is that aspiration goes and aspirates a 5 to 10 centimeter segment of the small bowel, right? So, and then we take that sample and try to extrapolate that data to 6 meters of small bowel, 20 feet of small bowel. So that's just naive to think that that's a completely perfect representative sample, right? So it has false positive rate because of contamination, and it does have false negative rate because of the sampling error, right? So those are the problems with the aspiration. Now you want to compare that to breath testing, obviously. When you compare and try to use sensitivity and specificity for a test, a gold standard needs to exist. And well, a gold standard doesn't exist in this situation. It's just an agreement exists between the two. And if anything, these two tests are complementary rather than one of them being gold standard, not the other one not. So now the difference between glucose and lactulose, now it goes to, okay, how long glucose travels and how long lactulose travels. But the reason why I think glucose, the research field and all, as it works, but then it comes to the clinic, I'm like, we're the positive ones, so I get stuck, is I think it's because when we do it in the clinic, patients are fasting, right? I'll give you an example, for example, right? So when a patient is hypoglycemic, what do? We give them glucose tablets, right? And right away, within minutes, the glucose goes up. The glucose gets absorbed starting from the mouth all throughout, right? So glucose, when it gets absorbed, obviously the concentration of that decreases significantly. And that is in part driven by the glucose level of that patient that is doing the glucose testing, right? And obviously, it's a little bit on the lower side because they're fasting for 12 hours or at least 8 hours, right? So glucose is continuously being absorbed. So one big problem with glucose is that as it travels through the small bowel, if it reaches there, it significantly decreases in terms of how much glucose is in there. So you have no idea, for example, in your jejunum, how much of glucose is being exposed to the bacteria, which is a problem if you're looking for hydrogen production using glucose, right? So that's why I think it fails in the clinical practice because it's just at the glucose absorption among patients is highly variable, and how much glucose reaches the small bowel and how much of it reaches the jejunum ileum is going to be highly variable. And I think in clinical practice, we need, I use lactulose, and that's the reason why. Now, There's a fair criticism to that somebody with rapid small bowel transit, then lactulose can reach to the colon and then hydrogen production occurs and you pick up colonic fermentation as small bowel fermentation in somebody with ultra rapid small bowel transit. But there are a couple of things that needs to be considered here. A very elegant study was done in 1989, and we won't be able to do this anymore, is that they used to give catheters with a weight filled with mercury in them to people would swallow it, and this would travel into the gut, and they would do x-rays on them until they're like, oh, it's in the cecum, right? So think about it, a catheter sitting in your mouth, it's gone all over it. And it's full of mercury. If that opens up, things that won't happen again. So what they did is that they put that into the cecum and they started putting lactulose in it at the rate of 0.15 gram per minute. And they just waited to see how long does it take for the hydrogen to go up in your breath. And it takes about 40 minutes for the hydrogen to go up by 20 parts per million in the breath, even when you're just infusing continuously the lactulose in the cecum. So that just tells you that there is a lag between exposure of the lactulose to the bacteria, even in an area that is nuclear amount of bacteria is just sitting there, like the cecum, that takes that much time to produce hydrogen. So that's why 40 minutes is there, right? And unless your small bowel transit is like 10 minutes, think about it, it's 20 feet, right? So if for something to go through a lumen in 10 minutes and that lumen is 6 meters, that's very fast. Is it possible? Yes, it is possible, but it's rare. And so you're not going to get those false positive tests. So I think the thought of false positivity of lactulose is a little bit exaggerated. And that's why I just use lactulose in my clinical practice. And I think you do too, because otherwise I think I'm going to miss a lot of SIBO patients that otherwise we'll get to the next doctor and get antidepressants maybe, right? So, yeah.
Yep, exactly. It happens.
Yeah.
Okay, Allison, I have
another question. We have 17 seconds left, so go.
Okay, I have another question for you, Ali. Sorry, I'm adjusting my light. The sun is streaming in here. 1 second. Okay, so on one of your studies, there was something that was just, you know, tucked away in there, one sentence that came out in DDW, that was a bit shocking and that I'd love for you to talk about. And that is that you identified lactobacillus as a small intestine microbiome disruptor.
Yes.
In one of
it was a surprise to me too. So I don't know what to tell you. So, cause you know, traditionally we considered lactobacillus as the healthy guy, right? So like something that you can find in yogurt, something that you can find all over, right? So, I mean, the role of, for example, lactobacillus in vaginal microbiome is proven, right? But you know, there's a difference between gut microbiome and vaginal microbiome, especially in the terms of pH, right? So that's actually a prime example of one bacteria being helpful in one area is not necessarily helpful in other areas as well. So what we saw essentially, granted, this is an association, meaning that we saw that when lactobacillus was going up, the network of bacteria are breaking. So the network of bacteria is that, well, it's a bioinformatics sort of like a design. Essentially, it looks at interaction of multiple bacteria and builds of a complex network. And the complexity of the networks is counted similar to any other network by how many lines, how many dots are there that we call nodes, and how many lines are connecting these nodes together. So the complexity of this network significantly was reduced in people who have excessive amount of lactobacillus, to our surprise. So Now, it is possible that there is somebody else that is decreasing everything, including the network, and pushing the lactobacillus up. I don't know. But definitely there was this association that we observed. But that's one thing that we need to keep a lookout to see if this gets reproduced in future studies.
Yeah, because, you know, we have so many studies and even patients who do take lactobacillus orally and get benefit. Not everybody does, but, you know, so even people with SIBO. So it's like, what? You know, I think patients may do when they hear about this is they may go, oh my gosh, I have to stop taking lactobacillus acidophilus, you know?
I don't think we're there yet. It's just obviously any discovery happens at one point and then needs to be reconfirmed and then further down. And remember, lactobacillus family, it's not like a tiny family, right? So there's a ton of different strains. And I wouldn't be surprised that some of them are helpful and some of them are harmful. So this is not at a point that you would make any clinical recommendation based on. This is just a finding.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah. Okay. And then another one that was interesting was that you found, you've been able to identify Klebsiella as one of the main overgrown bacteria in hydrogen SIBO. Hmm. And I was fascinated that in one of the studies you found that even when it was present at sub-SIBO levels, that it was involved in pathology.
Right.
And if you just talk about that, that would be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and again, this goes back to your point about disruptors, right? So there are literally bullies among microbiome, just like when you have bullies in the school. So one bully can disrupt the whole school as opposed to a few calm guys that just behave abnormally. So that's essentially the same thing. Klebsiella, they do have the capability of affecting the fungi. The other bacteria, they produce biofilm, so they mess things further up. And now there is data even emerging that they can affect the permeability of the gut. So essentially, they can wreak a havoc in the small bowel. And on top of it, they produce a lot of transmitters, right? Classic production of histamine by Klebsiella is a problem, right? So that's one thing. So they can even have systemic effects, these bacteria. And that's obviously, and that's why I was saying that it's exciting times, because now we're instead of like talking about like big groups of bacteria, now we're getting focused on different specific disruptors and see that if we can suppress those, and that would be enough to regain the microbial balance. Because think about it, the more tailored and more precision that we have there, we can have more precision medicine therapy for that approach, as opposed to empiric, sort of, for example, antibiotic therapy. So that's why it makes it very interesting. And also, it is it makes it possible that, okay, I found this specific bacteria. Let's see what it produces that it can suppress rather than killing it. To make the balance better. So that's obviously another sort of interesting door that it opens.
Have you been looking into those kinds of treatments?
Well, no, I think about it this way, right? So there is, for example, histamine, right? That is being produced. So should be a target intraluminal histamine. So that's one pathway, right? Serotonin as being produced by a lot of bacteria, should we target intraluminal serotonin? Having said that, that's easier said than done. Suppression of intraluminal biomarkers is extremely hard because no medication is just going to get distributed evenly throughout the guts, right? So that's a problem. But those are doors that are being opened as potential therapeutic pathways.
Well, on that note of treatment, can you just share with us what antibiotics or antibiotic combinations you're currently using for the different types of SIBO and EMO?
So antibiotic use, I mean, you know, in practice and to be pragmatic, so antibiotic use is obviously driven by many factors, right? Patient preference, and obviously the testing, the results, and also patient symptomology, and sadly enough, insurance, what gets covered, what doesn't get covered, right? So that's real life, right? So for treatment of somebody who is treatment naive for SIBO, no antibiotics in the past, I definitely reach for rifaximin first, which I think is the safest drug that is out there, and it has very little systemic absorption, the safety of it, if you know it from hepatic encephalopathy, IBS trials, that is very good. The problem, cost, right? So that's one issue that we have with it. But, you know, that's the ideal world, right? So that's what I reach for. Other treatments for hydrogen predominant bacterial overgrowth, I used to use ciprofloxacin a lot, but the problem with ciprofloxacin is the black box with the arthritis that can happen. It's rare, but when it happens, it does have that's a problem, right? And because of that, I do use doxycycline as one of my other options that I use. There is data on metronidazole as well, but you know, metronidazole again, it's not a well tolerated medication. Some people get nausea with it, although a lot of people do tolerate that. So those are some of the options that I use. In terms of EMO, obviously we target hydrogen production, so the methanogens are not capable of producing methane, and then we target methanogens themselves. So you need something to suppress the hydrogen production, something similar to rifaximin, and then something to suppress methanogens. So neomycin is one option. There was some shortages in neomycin, so we had to switch to flagyl, but now actually neomycin is becoming more available, which is good news. I like neomycin because it's, again, poorly absorbable. You know, whenever we can avoid systemic absorption of the antibiotic, I think we should do it for sure. So because that's more of a tailored management. So essentially my treatment becomes rifaximin plus neomycin. If rifaximin is not an option, then I have tried a ciproflagyl as a combination. Also, I have tried augmentin as well, which is essentially amoxicillin and clavulanic acid together. So that does have an effect on both of them. So those are the treatment. When it comes to hydrogen sulfide, I do try a rifaximin. I sometimes combine it with bismuth if patient is not constipated or doesn't get constipated with bismuth. Some people are sensitive to bismuth. They just get really constipated. But there is data that it does suppress the hydrogen sulfide. So I start that dose very slow because I don't know. Some people are very sensitive to bismuth. Bismuth tablets come in bizarre dose of 262 milligrams. So I usually try one tablet twice daily and work my way up to see what's because, you know, I don't want a patient to say that, well, thanks for fixing my diarrhea, but I haven't had a bowel movement for a week. So that's not a good outcome. So that's how I approach it.
Allison, that was great.
That was amazing. Thank you. Well, of course, a page full, but I'll
all day.
I'll limit it. okay, there's two more I just really wanted to get to. And we may only have time for one. So I know you all did a study on artificial sweeteners, and I know a lot of our patients are very interested in that. And if you, I mean, just briefly, I know the description was you took folks who use carbohydrate-based artificial sweeteners and then versus aspartame, which is non-carbohydrate. Can you just tell us anything about it? I mean, I'm a little concerned people are going to go, oh no, I can't use this sweetener or that. And I think, again, we're not there yet. So
yeah, so we're definitely not there yet. So remember, probably have looked at the literature. Artificial sweeteners are kind of under fire in multiple sort of like fields, in the field of endocrinology, in the field of aging, in the field of diabetes. And so remember, people who take artificial sweeteners, they're taking it for a reason, right? So because of that reason, it's not really, whether it's because of obesity, it's because of diabetes, it's because of like other medications that they're on. And for that reason, their microbiome is already different because they're different from the others, right? So that's one thing to look at, because for example there were like studies that showed that, okay, for example, coffee improves mortality, essentially the multiple studies that showed that in Annals of Internal Medicine. But if you sweeten that coffee with like more than a three tablespoon of sugar, or you use artificial sweetener, that effect goes away. But the thing is that, who puts artificial sugar in their coffee? Somebody who wants to avoid calories, right? So because of that, well, of course, if you compare a diabetic versus a non-diabetic patient, the rate of mortality because of heart disease is going to be different, right? So it's not because of that sugar or that artificial sweetener specifically, right? So, but what's interesting is that these studies try to get rid of these confounders as much as they can, but it's never 100%. That's why I think we're not there in terms of saying that, oh, no, do not touch any artificial sugars because they cause all sorts of troubles. We're at least from the gut microbiome standpoint. These are just hypothesis generating sort of studies and findings that sort of instigates further studies to see whether these are true or not. These are, again, not at the level that we make clinical recommendations.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Allison, I hate to do it, but we have to go.
No, we got
to
wrap up.
Thank you, Dr. Seebecker, for the excellent questions and co-hosting with me. Thank you, Dr. Razai. We really appreciate you. Godspeed in your work, sir. We're praying and sending good vibes to everyone over there. And we really
thank you so much for all the work you do and all the answers to these questions.
All right. You're welcome. Anytime.
Oh, yeah, good. He said anytime, Allison. Anytime.
Can we meet with you after ACG in the fall?
Yeah, sure. Post Vancouver. Yes. All right.
Okay. All right. All right. Send our best to everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Allison, I'll see you at 4:15.
Got it.
Okay. Great job. Mwah.